Okay, if folks could please take their seat. Well, welcome back from lunch. I apologize, it was abbreviated. That's not our habit. We like to have long lunches so we can have scientific discussions, but no doubt we had some of those anyway. So what we'd like to do is have a couple presentations, one a lessons learned and then a case study proposal. And the lessons learned is by Alan Mihajlovic. Sorry.
You were close.
That was not actually close at all.
Being nice.
But Alan has been associated with endocrine disruption for quite some time. And about a year ago, there was a yet another alliance project. I think this had quite a few different groups pulled together. And it was the folks that have actually been doing the screening programs that the USAPA laid out. And the idea of, hey, we've done all these tests. Let's pull people together that have done the test. And what can we learn from these various tests? I mean, some tests were well done and others it was difficult to do, and she's going to give us this whole idea of lessons learned. And we very much look forward to it, as I know USEPA did, because there was a meeting about a month after this meeting of the Alliance and its various components, and the lead EPA person came up to me and was very enjoying the fact that that you folks had done this. So, Ellen, you have the floor.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for having me here today. It's okay. I guess it sounds really funny when you're actually talking. To tell you a little bit about some of the lessons we've learned over the last few years as the chemical industry and EPA have been working through the endocrine disruptor screening program, the first round of it. And I want to start with just mention a couple of things. The first is essentially why in my credentials for standing here in front of you today to talk about this. Among other things, I am the scientific coordinator for the Endocrine Policy Forum. The Endocrine Policy Forum is a consortium of greater than about 95% of the List 1 test order recipients. So these are the people that are actually doing the testing, doing the work. And we also have additional stakeholders, including some consulting companies and some industry trade organizations. And our goal really has been to share information and share experiences and interact with EPA as a group rather than everybody going at them individually so that we can have a successful working through the endocrine program. The Endocrine Policy Forum, one of the things that we've done has been we've been very active in making public comments. Again, because we have the experience, we pool our data and so that we can have much stronger databases to try to evaluate and see how the program's working. And we've done some publications. So I have some of examples of all of those things as I go through the talk today. The other thing that I wanted to do was to give you a definition of an endocrine disruptor. This is very important as we talk about the framework of the Endocrine Disruptor Screening Program, or EDSP. This particular definition was put forward by the World Health Organization in 2002 and has been the one that's been generally accepted. There's a few key phrases in here that are very important to consider, and that is that an endocrine disruptor is an exogenous substance that alters function of the endocrine system, causing adverse health effects in an intact organism. Okay, those are intact organism, adverse health effects, very important components of a definition, and it often gets lost. I will say that the original WHO definition didn't include subpopulations, but I'm an environmental toxicologist, and we deal with populations rather than individuals, so I added that just because. All right, so how did we get here? I think it's good to, because I don't know how much everybody knows about the program. I think it's important just to kind of go back to how it all got started. So in 1996, the Congress passed the Food Quality Protection Act and the amendments to the Safe Drinking Water Act. And the Food Quality Protection Act, it was said that you have to screen, EPA has to screen pesticides for estrogenic effects. It did give them the opportunity, though, if they wanted to go further for other types of effects, they could do that, too. The key, though, to the FQPA was that they had to use appropriate validated test systems. So there's a lot of question about how long, why it's taken so long. Well, it takes a long time to validate new studies. So that's been one thing that's kind of slowed the process a little bit. Safe Drinking Water Act amendments, one of the thing there was can screen drinking water contaminants to which substantial numbers of persons are exposed. Unfortunately, they neglected to define substantial numbers, and so that's going to be as we get into the subsequent lists and chemicals are picked because of Safe Drinking Water Act, I think there's going to be some discussion there about why certain chemicals are picked. From a history perspective, so we had 1996, those two legislative mandates were passed. EPA then developed a federal advisory committee called the Endocrine Disruptor Screening and Testing Advisory Committee, or EDSTAC, which is what I will, if I ever have to say it again, that's what I'll say. This was a multi-stakeholder advisory committee that was what they were doing was they were trying to put together what's this going to look like? How are we going to assess chemicals for endocrine effects? They took 2 years to do that, came out with a report, and then from 1999 till today, EPA has been working to validate the screens, have had to ditch some of them, put in some new ones, some things that didn't work, and has also been working globally within the OECD these are not always EPA studies, they're globally harmonized studies also, or screens. All right, so what came out of this was a two-tiered system. Tier one is for screening, and there's 11 screens in tier one, and this tells you the potential. What it's supposed to be doing is identifying the potential for a chemical to interact. This is not an endocrine disruptor. If you go through tier one, you're not an endocrine disruptor. You're just identifying the potential to interact with the endocrine system. There are also, as I said, there's 11. It's a battery approach. The EDSTAC was very clear that they wanted to have redundancy in these. There's a lot of false positives. They're very sensitive. Most of these screens are very sensitive. And so they felt it was important to have this as a battery approach. And this information that comes out of Tier 1 is not designed to be used in a risk assessment. And that's another very important part, and one that both industry and EPA are working to sort of fight against with other regulatory authorities. Tier two was for testing, and these are the gold standard studies that we typically use. Well, some of them not so much yet, but we will be. Gold standard studies for determining adverse effects, characterizing adverse effects, and so. You go through tier one, you determine the potential. Tier two is when you get the answer that you can use for risk assessment. Here's the battery of 11 screens. The first five are in vitro. The next six are in vivo. So you have five in vitro screens for looking at estrogen receptor binding, androgen receptor binding, aromatase, steroidogenesis. And then you have the eutrophic, Hirschberger, male and female rat pubertal studies, the fish short-term reproduction, and the amphibian metamorphosis. One of the things that we found, that learning curve, is especially things like the male and female pubertals and the fish and frog, you have a number of apical endpoints in there, which make things that can be impacted by other modes of action. And so that's important to understand as you're going through this, that you got to be very careful. And again, why you have some redundancy throughout the with the different hypotheses, the different modes of action that you're looking at, so that you can make sure that if you do have an effect, it does actually fit the picture, if you will. The one thing that I neglected to mention at the beginning was when Congress passed this, they thought this was going to be a very quick program and a very cheap program. Someone told them that you could do a an e-screen for, what, $70 or something, was that, Jim? Something like that. And so you should be able to do an e-screen and come up with an answer. Well, this Tier 1 screening is neither quick nor cheap. It really has taken industry two to three years to get the data in. And for one chemical to go through all 11 screens, it's $750,000 to $1 million, one chemical, just to go through screens that only give you the potential that you may have an interaction. Okay. Here are the 11 screens again, and just to show you the different the modes of action that we're looking at, Congress told EPA to look at estrogen. EDSTAC said, okay, we're going to look at estrogen, androgen, thyroid, and steroidogenesis. So those are the ones that we're interested in here. I should point out now that I have this up here is that one of the things that the Endocrine Policy Forum has done, and we've been very interested in the whole issue of weight of evidence, and I have some citations later on, but what we've done is we've looked at these as hypotheses. So is your chemical acting like an estrogen agonist? Is it acting like an estrogen antagonist? And that sort of thing. All the way down, we have 8 hypotheses. And it's really important to do this. If you think about this, there are a lot of endpoints. There are actually 89 endpoints in all 11, when you add up the endpoints in all 11 assays. And just by chance, you're going to have something that's going to trip. All right? So when you divide them up by hypothesis, then you can say, all right, does fish vitalogenin, is that meaningful for an estrogen agonist hypothesis? Well, yes, it is. Is it meaningful for steroidogenesis? Probably not so much. Or thyroid? Probably not at all. So endpoints weigh differently depending on the hypothesis that you're looking at. And so that's one of the lessons learned that we've had is to take this from a hypothesis standpoint. Okay. Giving you the Tier 1 screens, here are the Tier 2 tests. So it's not a battery. The Tier 1 is a battery. Remember, you have to look at all of them that you've done. Tier 2 is not a battery, at least that's what EPA is telling us. The specific tests are going to be selected by them depending on the results of Tier 1. So far, out of the 5 Tier 2 tests, one of them is valid, I would say, and that's the RAT2 gen or the extended 1 gen study. We recently had an SAP this year or last year that looked at the 4 eco studies, and pretty much a science advisory panel said that they don't really consider them to be valid. Now, unfortunately, that's not going to stop us from having to use them, but and understandably, they're long studies. They're expensive studies. I gave you about $1 million for Tier 1. We're estimating this to be $3 to $5 million per chemical if they had to do all 5. So those are the list of the studies that we've got. All right, here's a bit of a risk assessment quandary, or a identification quandary, if you will. All right, so Tier 2 is for determining the adverse effects and to provide data for risk assessment. But in regulatory talks, what do? We test to an effect, right? Now, these are big studies with lots of endpoints that are apical in nature. So how are we going to really determine if the effect is specifically endocrine-related? All right. It's not such a big deal in the U.S. because we have a risk-based regulation. It is a huge deal in Europe because currently in Europe, it's a hazard-based regulation. And you can be authorized or off the market if they decide that you're an endocrine disruptor. And so it's going to be a real challenge to work through this from a risk assessment perspective and a hazard perspective to really understand what the results of these Tier 2 studies mean and whether or not they are actually endocrine related. Another thing that came out of the legislation was that EPA was told that they should use other scientifically relevant information, or OSRI, as best they can. And that is so that they can reduce the amount of animal testing. Going through list one of the issues was, again, unfortunately, we didn't probably go through as much validation as we all would have liked. And I think that, in general, there was a concern on the part of the agency to accept data when it wasn't to the specific guideline that we were being told to test with. So this function... Oh dear, sorry, went too fast. Pushed the wrong little button. All right. go back. Okay. So get the right one. Functionally equivalent. So they were looking at it more as it had to be more or less the exact screen, the exact guideline. We're hoping that in the future that a lesson learned from list one will be that the data doesn't need to be generated by the exact guideline to be functionally equivalent. We really are, I think, seeing that that's not necessarily required. And we have a lot more experience now. Okay, the listing process, I just wanted to mention that EPA has been very clear in its documents that the lists of chemicals are not lists of endocrine disruptors. Again, the legislation is based on exposure and whether or not there's exposure. Actually, for pesticides, it's just that it was part of the re-registration of pesticides, and so that's how they got on the list. But it is a real challenge that people misuse these lists. And they, unfortunately, are misusing these lists in the states as well as in other geographies. So if there's anything that we can learn is these are not lists of endocrine disruptors. And we think that the potential is going to be very high when the EPA makes decisions on list one to go on to from the tier one studies to go on to tier two. All right, so list one, just again to put everybody on the same page, list one was 67 chemicals, and 58 of them were pesticide active ingredients, 8 voluntarily canceled, so we actually only tested 50 pesticides. There were 9 pesticide inert ingredients. 2 were taken into the EDSP. 7 of them, there was an opt-out clause that said as long as you don't sell to the pesticide industry, you don't have to do this. So 7 of them said, well, we're not going to sell to the pesticide industry anymore. They'll have to just reformulate around us. And but 2 did move forward. We understand in List 2 that opt-out clause has been taken out. So you're not going to have that option anymore. List 2 was actually finalized last year. This is 109 substances, still about in. Now it's a more even mix of pesticides and chemicals, so a lot of things are being brought in because of Safe Drinking Water Act. The Office of Management and Budget still has that list, and they have not approved it as of yet, and they can't. No test orders are going to be released until they do so. So we're kind of in a holding pattern right now, waiting for data evaluations to come out from EPA from List 1. So what have we learned? All right. As Mike said earlier, there was a great workshop that Tara hosted back in April of last year called Lessons Learned. If you see here, the report from that workshop is right here. It's in all text and open access, so you can access it and get a lot more information than I'm going to be able to tell you today from it. We had 240 scientists from government, academia, industry, nonprofits, either in the room or on a webinar. It was very well attended, excellent discussions, and we had 3 focal areas: performance of the screens and the battery, the use of the data, and then looking to the future of what we might be seeing in the future. So just looking at some lessons learned in the performance of the screens. Actually, labs did a really good job through this process of the last couple of years identifying some of the problems with the in vitro studies and modifying them so that they worked better. And we're hoping that at some point those modifications will actually find their way back into the guidelines so that we'll actually have those changes in the guidelines. The in vivo mammalian assays actually did pretty well. We think, in general, I mean, they worked. I mean, they didn't have a lot of problems with them, although there were some technical and interpretive challenges, specifically with the pubertal assays, actually. And then again, part of that's because there's apical endpoints in there, so if you're trying to get at mode of action, it makes it a little harder when you then have, you know, body weight effects or other things, and then you don't know whether it's endocrine or not. We do need to address a few technical challenges with the fish and frog. One of the things that we had, for example, with the frog was they had a high incidence of bent tail, and we think it has something to do perhaps with husbandry. When they grow too fast, you know, they're too healthy, they can't all, their body can't quite keep up. So there's some issues like that that we're trying to work through to make them work a little bit better. Some others with the performance of the screens. Really, and this, I mean, these are the things that kind of came out of the Tara workshop. And just as we know, you shouldn't use Tier 1 screening data in isolation for risk assessment purposes, because this is only to identify the potential. It's not for adverse effects. These screens actually only have 2 to 3 dose levels. So again, you're not putting together a dose response, really. We are concerned that screening data is going to be used in lieu of more robust risk assessment data by other regulatory authorities. We've already seen, California's asked, but there's also been quite a number of European and Latin American countries that have been trying to get this information too. And we really want EPA to be able to evaluate it and look at it from a weight of evidence perspective. So we're hoping that that process can keep going. Overt toxicity is a real problem, and it may overwhelm normal physiological functions. You think about if you have pretty significant body weight gain reduction, then you really can start to say, well, it's not really an endocrine effect. It may be secondary to something else. Some practical applications of the data. Out of the TERRA workshop, again, that there needs to be a systematic, transparent, and quantitative weight of evidence approach, incorporating things like dose response, the odds re-information, and potency. Very, very big recommendation there. Staging may allow some gatekeeper assays to inform subsequent testing requirements. I'm going to talk just a second about gatekeeper assays. And that we really may want to have some sort of supplemental data that's someplace between Tier 1 and Tier 2 before jumping right into very expensive Tier 2 studies that may help clarify what we found in Tier 1 and then maybe prevent having to go on to Tier 2. And then there's some alternative methods that could be useful to provide additional information as long as they are fit for purpose. The gatekeeper concept was actually presented by two people from EPA, although they will say this is not an EPA process here, or approved or whatever. And that's this, if you think about the fact that a lot of the endocrine system is very conserved, and they noticed in looking at the studies that there was a high concordance between the fish and the rat assays. Probably makes a few toxicologists in here squirm a little bit. I understand that, but we really can play in the same sandbox. It actually turned out the fish did a little bit better on steroid hormone inhibitors, while androgen receptor antagonists were clearer in the rat assays, but still they had very high concordance between the two. And their bottom line, their suggestion was that if you had no effects in those two studies, and that's the male rat, no effects in those two studies, that really then that should mean that that chemical is not going to be very highly prioritized for further testing, because you're unlikely to have effects in other of the screens anyway. As Mike mentioned, I think, earlier too, along with the TERRA workshop, we had 4 EPA SAPs last year. Now, 1 or 2 SAPs, okay, fine. 4, that was a real challenge for those of us that were providing comments at all 4 of them. I'm sure it was a huge challenge for EPA to put all of the information together. In January, it was the prioritization, looking at the use of high-throughput tools for prioritization. In May, we had the Tier 1 screening assays and battery. In June, it was the Tier 2 ecotox tests, and July was weight of evidence. You can find information on the EPA website about all of these. So from a prioritization standpoint, really what we're seeing is, tox testing in the 21st century and EDSP 21 is wanting to move more towards high throughput kinds of methodologies, at least for prioritization to start, but they would like to move it on to actually replacing some screens and tests in the end. And that's because, if you think about it, we've been doing this since 2009, and we've done 52 chemicals. There's 10,000, supposedly, in the data set that need to go through this at some point. So we're going to have to come up with some other ways to do this. Takeaway message from the SAPs were that there was a concern on the part of the SAP that some mechanisms could be missed and that we might need some more screens. They really did encourage additional transparency on the generation and use of data. These methodologies are typically, most of them are proprietary. So industry is not going to be running these. EPA is going to be running these. And there's a lot that it's not very transparent how they make certain decisions about whether something's positive or negative. And so there just needs to be more transparency. The SAP did recommend including exposure information in the process, and they encouraged less reliance on expert opinion and more on the systematic process. The Tier 2 screening battery, the Tier 1 screening assays in the battery, the background there was EPA analyzed 21 out of the 52 chemicals and brought those forward to the SAP. And the takeaway message was they encouraged EPA to do all 52 and then amend guidelines as appropriate, because there's clearly some of the guidelines that maybe we don't need, some things that need to be changed, so they said do all 52. It'd be great if there were some more positive and negative controls that could be used to challenge the systems. Definitely we saw that the performance criteria in a few of them may not be appropriate. We were losing studies and having to repeat studies because of the performance criteria, and if that's the case, maybe they're not set correctly. Overt toxicity, again, could confound the results. They definitely saw that. And they said we need to probably have a better understanding of control performance and normal variability. And that's actually one project that the Endocrine Policy Forum is currently involved in. We're gathering control data from almost every compound that the EPF members have run, and we're going to be doing some publications on that just to get at what is the normal control variability in this. Tier 2 ecotox tests. Here was the review of the validation studies, and I don't think I touched anything. Oh, there we go. It's back. Review of the validation studies and the guidelines. And the takeaway messages from this are that there were some problems with concordance between labs, but again, there wasn't a lot of labs involved in these. These are huge studies. But they said that maybe they need to do a little more standardization, and it may not be possible to separate endocrine from non-endocrine responses. I mean, we're hearing the same theme over and over again. And really, while they said the BERT test might be possibly valid, but some of the endpoints are not, the other three ecotox studies, they specifically said they didn't think that they were valid yet. And then the last one was weight of evidence. So they did a weight of evidence assessment on 5 compounds. 4 of them were compounds that actually went through Tier 1 and were on List 1, Tier 1. And the 5th one was a chemical that was just evaluated for other scientifically relevant information, looking at weight of evidence. And the takeaway messages here was, again, they encouraged more transparency. Why did you do what you did? They commented that the weight of evidence should be more quantitative and consistent. They actually endorsed the quantitative methods that the Endocrine Policy Forum put forward, and that's down here the two citations for the two. In fact, if you're really interested in lessons learned, I would direct you to the birth defects research. It was a special edition in 2014. This year, it's the whole journal is open access. It's going to give you everything you wanted to know about what industry went through and some of the lessons learned and everything. There's still a lot of questions remaining about how weight of evidence is going to be used to request Tier 2 tests. And they also said, just as we said during the Terra workshop, that maybe there's some sort of supplementary information that should be developed between Tiers 1 and Tiers 2 to help clarify whatever we might have found in Tier 1. And so what does the future hold? All right, what EPA wants to do, and it makes perfect sense, is to really think about the EDSP 21 and what's in their comprehensive management plan, and actually what I think President Obama had suggested, which is to move towards more high-throughput screens and take a more integrated approach for assessing this. And so EPA is working very hard right now on looking at in silico models and high-throughput screens and including a measure of exposure. They have a program called ExpoCast that can get at exposure. And their objectives of this is that in the short term to use these methodologies for prioritization, right, what chemicals are our low-hanging fruit that we should test first, moving into replacing some of the screens, and then ultimately replacing tests. That's way in the future, I think. ToxCast, for those of you that don't know, is a battery of more than 700 in vitro high-throughput screens, primarily using human cells or human cell lines. And currently, EPA has profiled over 2,000 chemicals in this. And of those 700, about 15% of them are directly relevant for the endocrine disruptor screening program. So they're estrogen, androgen, thyroid. And they want to be able to use this kind of information in adverse outcome pathways. Adverse outcome pathways are a conceptual framework that portrays the knowledge that we gain concerning a linkage between some type of initial molecular event here on this end down to a response, an organism or a population response. So it's, can we take information from this end of the line here? Of course, this looks like a very nice linear process, doesn't it? Unfortunately, biology doesn't quite work that way. But still, taking information from organs and cells and predicting essentially what kind of effect you might have in the end. Here's just an example of one that has come out of the lab in Duluth. So if we take an aromatase inhibitor like fadrozole that might have an impact in reducing estradiol, aromatase is the enzyme that takes testosterone to estradiol at the end of the steroidogenic pathway. So if you have a reduction in estradiol, you might have a reduction in phytalogenin synthesis, since that's the egg yolk protein in female fish, and estradiol is key to that. And so then you might end up with a reduction in fecundity, which is clearly an issue from a population standpoint, right? So again, the issue here is, does this work in this nice straight line? And what I would say, and this came out of the Terra workshop also, is with these new technologies, they do hold great promise for improving our understanding, but statistical correlations and simplistic pathways are insufficient to demonstrate causal relationships. And we really need to, since we know that biology works in complex networks, we need to find ways to block parts of this pathway, block steps in the pathway to determine true causality. And it was very clear in the Terra workshop that validation of these approaches really needs to include all the stakeholders so that there's good acceptance of these high throughput assays and prediction models. So the challenge to me, again, or to you all, as you're talking about risk assessment, is how do we use AOPs in risk assessment? And with that, I'll take any questions. Oh, I'm sorry. It says the first clue that your new chemical might be an endocrine disruptor. And they're all going to the female bathroom.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much. So, do we have questions for Ellen? Yes, Betty.
Just who's responsible for the testing for the drinking water contaminants?
That's a good question. Well, it would be the registrants of the chemicals.
If they're industrial chemicals,
yes.
Or right,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. One of the problems that's actually the 109 list two, which has 109, had 140 some before, and one of the problems was that a number of orphan chemicals that are no longer supported by anybody were on there, and so as comments came back in. Those sorts of things were pointed out to EPA, so they were removed from the list. Yeah.
Well, so a follow-up question, is EPA stepping up and doing any of the testing themselves for some of these orphan chemicals or no?
No.
Okay. Other questions for Ellen?
I shouldn't speak for EPA. I don't know what they might be doing in different places, but I don't believe they are.
Okay. So I have a question that it's more theoretical because Dr. Buss is talked in terms of if we had tested some natural chemicals like, juice from pears or something. I don't know if that was not his example. I'm just kind of making that up. What kinds of tests would you, in this screen program, what would you expect, or has anybody tested natural chemicals in these screens just as a positive or negative or any kind of control?
I don't have the reference, but Tinwell, I don't remember now what journal they published in, but there is one out there, a paper out there that has looked at natural chemicals. And in fact, actually, I teach a short course an endocrine short course. I've done it a number of times now at CTAC. And one of the things I have, I was just telling a couple of people at lunch, was that I have a slide that gives some data, pubertal data, and some other things about this chemical. And I just say, well, should we ban it? You know, or you know, do we think that this is an endocrine active chemical? And you know, usually I get, oh yes, it looks terrible. It's, you know, it's got an increase here and a decrease there and all of that. And at the end, I show what it is, and it's caffeine. So
caffeine. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think a lot of this that you have to think about too is exposure and potency. But it's the same thing with chemicals. I mean, natural chemicals and man-made chemicals are. It's the same, and
right.
we're really not seeing a lot of effects in these screens so far. So.
Okay, Jim, go ahead.
Just add another dimension to the conversation of the naturals, but it also applies to primarily the chemicals, and that's the whole issue of dosimetry and dose selection. And I've always been particularly sensitive to the fact that we shouldn't. Revisit what I would call kind of the sin of the past that started with genetic toxicology, where default concentrations for testing and genetic toxicology assays were set at 10 millimolar, which of course doesn't have any reality whatsoever to any meaningful human exposure by many orders of magnitude. So in the case of endocrine disruption, we've actually been able to successfully say, all right, if you make the investment in animal dosimetry, to understand what pharmacokinetic behavior is by way of example, and you see nonlinear pharmacokinetics, that you ought not, and particularly if the inflection point of those nonlinear pharmacokinetics occurs at a dose level that's substantially above demonstrated human exposures, you really shouldn't test at any higher doses than that. And in fact, that's now been institutionalized in some of these tier 2 tests, like the extended one-generation reproduction test, where they basically said you should not test at doses above nonlinear pharmacokinetics when that inflection point is substantially above human exposures. The other value of doing in vivo pharmacokinetic studies in your animal tox studies is to guide, again, your in vitro studies. So, again, the experience I've had with chemicals is, in the case of the one that I've worked with, where nonlinear pharmacokinetics comes into play, the default top test concentration in the in vitro EDSP assays is, I believe, 1 millimolar. Again, a very high concentration. And if you've got pharmacokinetic studies from your existing in vivo animal tox studies, which is not terribly unusual, when we did our particular EDSP screening with the chemical where we understood the pharmacokinetics, which turned out to be 2,4-D, we deliberately said we're not going to test at 1 millimolar because 1 millimolar is at a dose that would be the dose to a whole animal that would produce a 1 millimolar concentration would be so deep into the nonlinear pharmacokinetic range so as to make the study totally meaningless. So we limited the top dose to the inflection point concentration that we had identified in animal pharmacokinetic studies, which substantially reduced that 1 millimolar concentration to, I think, like a tenth millimolar, if I'm not mistaken, as a result of that kind of adjustment. But again, it's Alan describe something about the false negatives. This is really an attempt to avoid false positives because, I'm not fully confident that even though EPA has stated that if you do your in vitro screening assays and you get a positive, that's not a risk assessment. Elsewhere around the world, I think that's going to very rapidly spiral out of control and you're going to get labeled.
And how did EPA respond to your 1/10 millimole or whatever?
So far, they've said that's a reasonable approach to take.
Okay. Other questions from panel members? I had another question. So during the workshop, I recall vaguely this idea of trying to match. This is, I think, goes to a little bit of what you said, Jim. Try to match the concentrations that you might find in human serum out of NHANES assays. In other words, you'd take a pesticide and you'd say, well, what's the maximum concentration we found of this particular pesticide, scale it up by 1,000-fold, and then use that as the top dose. Am I remembering that correct, Alan? Or if not, is there something along those lines that's useful?
I vaguely remember that there was some discussion about other ways to set doses, and we've certainly had that discussion of how to set doses and how to pick doses.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I could mirror that back to you exactly. But certainly dose setting was a big issue, and it's still a big issue. I mean, interestingly, say, for example, the fish study, the U.S. guideline says the high dose is 100 milligrams per liter some portion of your LC50. In the OECD guideline, it's 10, because they know that 100 is too high, and you start to have a lot of other problems when you do that. But unfortunately, ours are set for 100 as the default.
Mm-hmm. So. And I guess another last question from my point of view, this idea of gatekeeper assays. So we had our gentlemen, our gentle people firm, US EPA, that proposed them, and we had gone through 50-some-odd chemicals. So how good were those two gatekeeper bioassays? Did they get 100% fidelity, or was it 10% what?
It's been a little while since I've actually read the paper to know exactly, but they had very, very high concordance with using those two assays with the outcomes of the studies. But okay. I think they were looking, though, at some of the positive and negative control data. I don't know that they were really looking at some of the 52 chemicals at that point.
Okay. So. Okay, any questions from the floor? Well, we have Jim. Go ahead, Jim. Then we'll
have one other question for Ellen, and that is on the fish studies, the results of the endocrine assays, screening assays from the fish studies, are they also intended to be useful for mammalian risk assessment in the end? Because one of the issues that I have concern with, you know, let's say you get a hit on a vitellogenin assay, does that mean then that you assume that to be a mammalian endocrine disruptor? Is that the dosimetry is really a challenge to convert from a fish exposure to a human exposure?
Okay, first thing, you keep saying endocrine disruptor. This is screening, and we're talking about the potential for endocrine activity and not endocrine disruptor. But you can actually, I think, look from a dosimetry standpoint, figure out what might be a more relevant concentration. But I don't think we're really looking at that point, again, from that particular study, you're looking at the potential. So, for example, vitellogenin is a very nice biomarker for an estrogenic exposure. But we don't do risk assessment based on vitellogenin. So, because it's just a biomarker, it's not it's not an adverse effect. So, I don't know that I totally answered your question, but I think that it will be, I don't know, well, it'll be interesting to see how we all play in the sandbox together. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, Betty?
Just to make the point that the assays that are being done are being drawn upon more broadly to inform, quantitative structure activity relationship analysis for priority settings. So that's hypothesized AOP is informing priority setting from QSAR, by QSAR. So in fact, with an objective to kind of reduce the amount of testing overall that's
right.
required.
Okay. Right. Do we have any questions from folks on the phone or comments? Okay, well, once again, thank you, Ellen. Okay, so our next presentation is by Dr. Moiz Mumtaz, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. And this is an idea. It's more or less akin to mixtures, which Moiz has kind of talked about before, about this idea of introducing mixtures. And this comes out of some work that the various agencies and actually world groups around the world have talked with methylmercury and which studies do we use and Faroes and Seychelles and other studies. And what's been found is, at least in the Faroes, there's more than just one kind of exposure. So, Dr. Moiz, I think we're going to give you the floor here.
All right. Thank you. Well, I want to first thank the panel to give the opportunity to present something. This is work in progress, if you want to call it information sharing, rather than a case presentation like you heard since morning. So I'll do the presentation, and as Author Mike will take the questions. Let's go with that. So basically, the issue of mixtures has been there for a long time, and there is a unique population in Faroe Island that are exposed to a bunch of things through seafood. And we want to see how we can apply alternative methods that are available for mixtures to doing the risk assessment of this unique combination, which consists of methylmercury, DDE, DDT, and PCBs.
Heather.
All right, good.
Can we expand that? There's a little, see that little sign up in the corner? Can we hit that and expand it to the, is that? That makes it worse.
Yeah.
Okay, forget I said that, sorry. Okay.
Okay. So one of the things is, seafood is unique in terms of its richness in nutrition, but there's always that possibility of accumulation of all kinds of contaminants in seafood. And Faroe Island is a unique population since that their major food source is seafood, and three chemicals important in this particular seafood, methylmercury, DDT, and PCBs. There will be other chemicals, but that has been the focus and debated for a long time in the last couple of decades. And so have been the methods for chemical mixtures. So Mike and I thought maybe we can combine that to see what kind of results we get when we apply the alternative methods. And if nothing else, to illustrate the challenges for risk assessors in general and chemical mixtures in particular. And the whole idea about risk assessment is to be realistic in what you're doing using the current data, and you want to be realistic in the sense that you don't want to either overestimate the risk using a bunch of uncertainty factors or underestimate it by adding so many uncertain factors. And we have seen what can happen since yesterday and this morning. Ed presented some information. So here's the consumption of seafood by the Faroe Island folks. It is the fish, 72 grams, pilot whale mussel, and pilot ear blubber. And these are the levels of mercury, methylmercury, and how much of that would be consumed by the people if they use all these three. And then we have no data. And again, that's another problem we encounter in risk assessment, is that we don't have all the data we need. And in this case, we don't have the data on PCBs or DDT. But you can see they consume a whole lot of methylmercury and PCBs and DDT. So when we are deriving reference doses, we always look at the experimental data and the epi data, and each one of them, not necessarily always, but have certain shortcomings in experimental data in animals and usually in high doses, and they're very defined exposures. You can do only so many dose groups and so forth. And usually for single chemicals, because the environmental laws have been for a particular chemical enacted for a particular chemical. If you look at the epi data, then we have human information, mostly from accidental studies at high concentrations. There's a lot of data on epi, data on complex exposures, but it becomes a real big issue in terms of to determine the exposures and indeterminate. And risk assessment, from what you have heard in the last few days, is always that even though a chemical might cause multiple toxicities, it is the first effect or the critical effect that's the you take and derive a reference dose based on the point of departure. And most often, that's where EPA in the 80s would stop. They would not look at other doses, or as the dose increases, that there are other health effects that are caused by the chemical. So based on that, then, for methylmercury and PCBs and DDT, we have reference dose for each one of them, and the critical effect for each one of them is different, and then we apply the uncertainty factors to derive the reference dose values. So that's where we are in terms of these three chemicals. And of course, you have heard about the uncertainty factors, a bunch of them, depending on the data, you can extrapolate from sensitive populations, animal to human, and a bunch of uncertainty factors. I just wanted to put this in perspective to keep that in mind, that uncertainty factors are part of our life when we are risk assessors. So transferring to the mixtures risk assessment, there are basically two general approaches we use. One is the mixture of concern. Basically, if you have tested a mixture of interest, and in this case those three chemicals, then you basically use that data as a single entity and you do the risk assessment. But most often we have single chemical data, and the rest of the talk I will focus on the component-based approach because that's all the data we have. So in 1986, EPA came with the guidelines, and they basically, in the guidelines, we state that use the critical effect of the of a particular component and use the reference dose, and it could be any allowable level, MRL, ADI, so forth. So the hazard quotient, as you all have seen since morning, is the exposure level over the reference dose. If we do that with only critical effects, you calculate the hazard quotient for each chemical, that is the exposure over the reference dose for each chemical, that's called the hazard quotient. You combine the hazard quotients to get the hazard index. And that's the basic concept on considering dose additivity, that there are no interactions. If we do that with these three chemicals, then based on the 1986 guidelines, we have some evaluation of hepatotoxicity, neurotoxicity, and immunotoxicity. But if these chemicals were causing other health effects, there would be no assessment done. And EPA realized that the principal polluters was using the critical effect and saying, look, we got all these three things and there's no problem with that. And they were not evaluating the other endpoints. So the full characterization of risk was not taking place as it was supposed to. So in 1989, EPA came up with risk assessment guidance for Superfund. And what they said is to use the reference dose for all effects a chemical can cause. So the hazard quotient, according to the RACs, has exposure over reference dose for all the effects that can be caused. Well, if you do that, then what happens is you get a good profile of all effects that are being caused, because now you're using in the denominator a reference dose for all these chemicals. But what it does is it overestimates risk because you're using a lower level in the denominator to evaluate the toxicity. So in 2000, EPA came with the revised guidance and they said, take all the effects and derive the target organ toxicity doses for each effect. Now, this is a concept which helps evaluate the toxicity, and so the hazard quotient, as you have seen, has been transformed from critical effects to major effects to now target organ toxicity doses. When you do that, you get a better characterization of risk. You're not overestimating certain endpoints. And this helps a complete profile of the chemical, not only chemical, when it's mixtures, if there are 50 chemicals, 30 chemicals, 10 chemicals, whatever they are, then you can evaluate various effects. So this concept of TTDs, we had come up with in 1997, and then we also even talked about interactions among chemicals, and we know that those most often are caused at higher toxicity effect. So if we look at the dose response curves we saw before, the target organ toxicity doses basically are derived for each one of them using the same concepts as looking at the point of departure and using uncertainty factors to derive the values. But now you have specific target organ toxicity doses for various endpoints. And so we looked at a database for all these chemicals and derived values for the three endpoints we were interested in. For the neurotoxicity, we have the methylmercury RFD, so that stays as the target organ toxicity dose. And then we have for PCBs, and for DDT, we did not have any data, so we could not drive a target organ toxicity dose for DDT. But you can see sometimes the uncertainty factors are quite big. For immunotoxicity, PCB, the RFD was derived based on immunotoxic effects, and we really could not find a whole lot of data. Now, this analysis, by the way, was done a few years back, Mike. And so now I see some data in 2007 that's published on immunotoxicity of methylmercury, but still there's not a whole lot in terms of actually deriving a value. It's more qualitative assessment. And finally, the hepatotoxicity, DDT has a RFD derived on that, and then we derived a target organ toxicity dose for both methylmercury and PCB, and those are the effects and those are the uncertainty factors. We go back and use the intake data to calculate how much each of these chemicals contribute based on the intake, and then we get a value for the hazard index for each of these effects. So for neurotoxicity, the hazard index was 40. For immunotoxicity, the hazard index is 180. It's basically driven by the PCB. And for hepatotoxicity, it is 11. So based on individual components, that's what we had done. The other thing which we can do according to the EPA guidelines is take one chemical as a marker of the exposure and convert everything to the toxicity equivalents. And this was something Mike had done. We looked at the NAS analysis where EPA estimated the BMDL at 1.08 for methylmercury. And then if we consider all the intake was similar, if 1.08 micrograms methylmercury was the intake, then it also is a combination of 9.1 micrograms of PCB and 6 micrograms of DDT. So if you look at the equivalents, then for a mixture, then we have 1.8 plus 9.1 plus 6, that is 16 micrograms per mixture per kilogram per day. And that's the BMDL. And if you apply the uncertainty factors for toxicokinetics and lack of information, we get an uncertainty factor of 10. Divide that 16 by 10, we get a 1.6 microgram per kilogram per day of the mixture. And if a woman is consuming that, that would be equivalent to 96 micrograms per day of the mixture. If we go back to the first consumption slide I showed you, then now we can see that compared to the 96 micrograms per day, the allowable level, those are drastically exceeded by for PCBs and for DDT through the blubber. And this is a culture in the Faroe Island that they eat the muscle as well as the blubber. And as you know, whale is at a higher trophic level in the marine life, so it accumulates a lot of these things. And until 1977, school teachers used to write to the students, please include blubber in the breakfast to the parents. There used to be a note every day until 1977. And then they started realizing there are a lot of problems with it. And so, again, this is really not a complete analysis, but basically from the limited data, we have seen that these exposures are complex. And based on the BMDL analysis, we can say that there's a concern for this exposure because it exceeded what is considered as the allowable level or the reference dose for the mixture. We really have not considered the covariates in this particular analysis. Not only we have not looked at other chemicals, but also the fact that the Faroese Island folks not only eat blubber and mussel, but they also eat the liver and the kidney, and they all accumulate these chemicals. So the exposures are much more complex than what we have presented here. And one of the things, just looking at it, you can tell right away that if you can get rid of blubber eating, that takes care of most of the problem. It drops below 96, which we had allowed. And if they can take care of the muscle part, then really there's it should not be an issue in terms of either immunotoxicity or neurotoxicity. So basically, this particular exercise kind of shows that there's a lot of data gaps, there's a lot of concern, but there are also, even though these might be rough calculations, we can come up with some guidance in terms of what can be done to mitigate exposures and keep people healthy. I think I stop right there, Mike. And
okay. Thank you.
Okay, questions from Moise, from panel members or the audience? Okay, I have a question regarding the Faroe Islands consumption advisories. And I know, Betty, you've done a lot of international work. I was dimly aware that there is a pilot whale blubber consumption advisory in the Faroes. Mm-hmm. But is anybody else aware of that as well, or am I not remembering that correct?
There have been advisories. In, I think, 2012, I saw something come out, Mike, that says that if you restrict at least twice a week instead of, I think, obviously they eat every day, so to speak. So there was some advice in terms of how to control, and also because of the education in the past couple of decades, the levels in the population on the younger people are coming down. So even though, if you look at even the recently caught whales, the values are similar, but in the populations they are coming down. So the education program they have put in place is helping them to bring the levels down in the population themselves.
Okay. Other questions? Jim?
Boys, can you clarify for me on the derivation of your acceptable exposure levels? Were you just simply adding up the hazard index of a variety of different toxicity endpoints, right? So what I'm, that's then operating under the assumption that those endpoints all share kind of a common mode of action. But if the mode of actions are operating independently of each other, the simple addition that you've done to pull those together would seem to be I'm challenged to think of the biological justification for doing that, because obviously if you've got multiple chemicals operating by different, completely different modes of action, they're going to be independent of each other, yeah. Particularly at low levels of exposure. So how did you work through that process in terms of deriving those values?
I think, again, as I said, Jim, this is a very rough cut, and the risk assessment guidance for Superfund, RACS 1989, says first add everything together, apples and oranges. It doesn't really matter. If it exceeds certain value, then you go and start doing into specific target organs and even mechanism. You are absolutely right. When we do dose additivity, we assume that one chemical is a dilution of other. It's only the potency which is different. So it's potency-weighted dose addition. And so there should be the same mechanism, same effect. And in this case, it is not the case. Yeah. So we're just trying to add something to say, going back to the RACS of 1989, where it says you can get an aggregate hazard index to see if it exceeds. If it exceeds you, then you do further analysis in more details. But if it doesn't exceed, you don't have to. So in a way, when you look at the consumption and the values, you can immediately say this has exceeded the value. So it needs further analysis. We just want to take a first cut to see what it does. But ultimately, we'll have to do further analysis to make sure that the mechanisms are the same and that they can be added and they're not independent of one another. But the fact that they're so high, even one chemical can basically, as you can see, is driving the issue. So in terms of, if you look at PCBs, if we can cut that down, we don't really need a mixtures analysis, so to speak, because only one chemical is driving the hazard index so high that if you control that, maybe we'll bring everything down by itself. And that's the reason the advisory Mike mentioned too is about don't eat blubber, even though only a couple of decades back they were saying make sure you add blubber to your children's breakfast or lunch.
Right. So it's interesting you raise that point, Jim, because the early guidance was if a chemical did not have a reference dose, then it didn't get counted. And so the mistake was made in the opposite direction. It was sort of a liberal thing. You know, you have 20 chemicals at the site or 10 chemicals, and only two of them have reference doses. So if you just pretend there's only two chemicals.
Yep.
And it's the opposite problem. And of course, then you would add all these chemicals together and use it as a screen. But then as soon as you exceeded a hazard index of one, a lot of people forgot it was a screen, and you have to go back and do more analysis. Betty has a really good paper where it talks about tier in exposure and tier in hazard index. And the first tier, the simplest one, is you add everything together, and if your margin of exposure exceeds something, Betty, if I'm getting this wrong, just correct me. If it exceeds something of concern, do you have a problem? And the answer is no, you have to do more work. You don't have a problem yet. You have to do more analysis.
Exactly.
To see if you have a problem.
And that's true with reference dose and MRLs and all those, that when the MRL is or reference dose is exceeded, you do further analysis. You go find out what is going on in terms of how further you can look into the mechanism, as Jim pointed out, or into bioavailability. You know, all the issues, then we have to look at it.
Or the exposure that
right.
Richard talked about
exactly.
Earlier. You know, another interesting thing about this is that when we had done this analysis a little bit, not all of this, but just a little bit, the Faroe Island infants, most of them are breastfed. And since their mothers ate blubber, the children in the breast milk were getting 600 times the reference dose for Aerochlor 1254. 600 times higher than the safe dose for EPA did the kids in breast milk. Mm-hmm. It was twice the lower observed adverse effect level in primates. It was really ugly as far as a health risk problem.
I think that blubber consumption analysis guidance, the advisory tells women and unmarried women and women not to eat if they're going to expect to have babies. So it's
right.
Just funny. I think of my house and say, how is it possible if someone is cooking food, she's the only one who is not going to eat, and I and my son or my children can eat. Culturally, and I think that's the problem we have several times, that the food and culture go together, and that creates a little problem. Jim.
So just out of curiosity, maybe you can, because I don't know, can't recall the exact details, but the Faroe Island children have been, of course, one of the most thoroughly studied cohorts in terms of neurodevelopment in childhood. And my vague recollection is those children aren't showing any significant developmental delays relative to the exposure to these chemicals. Do I have the picture right?
There's at least two cohorts, Seychelles.
There's a Seychelles, mm-hmm. Right.
Which has been also thoroughly studied. Right. They're two great studies. There's nothing wrong with these studies. They're wonderful.
Right.
But my understanding, and I haven't followed this literature for about 6 years, is the Faroe Island children are showing some effects.
And
the Seychelles Island children are not necessarily showing effects. Okay. And my response is, why am I not surprised? Because the Seychelles does not have this pilot whale muscle and blubber exposure as the Seychelles kids don't have it as the Faroe children or their parents do. But anyhow, go ahead. Betty, do you want to add to that or subtract?
I just wanted to indicate how supportive I am of tiered assessment. So, and it doesn't always need to be mode of action based. So the objective of tiered assessment, and we are pushed to consider tiered assessment from the perspective of where you're sorting with large numbers of compounds, the objective is really to do as little as is necessary to guide risk management or to set a group of chemicals aside from further consideration. So, I guess the challenge is, once you've done that in a very early tier, is communicating what that represents. And where the risk management fix is fairly clear and evident, I think you would provide guidance from that perspective to reduce the intake of some of those, particularly for that group of contaminants. It's exactly what Moyi said.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that all consideration of combined exposures needs to be based on common mode of action, because then you're exclusionary. You actually aren't going to have that information for a lot of compounds. You need to have a very clear rationale as to why you're grouping certain compounds together. It may be common target organs, they may be chemically similar, it may be a combination of those things, and see if you have a problem based on very crude estimations, probably overestimations, and if you don't have a problem, you don't need to do the assessment further. It is the origin, it's the familiarity with tiered assessments on the exposure and hazard side, which really highlights the importance of a very crude sensitivity analysis. Because in this case, if you'd done the exposure assessment, you would understand what's driving the most sensitive subpopulation. It's going to be those levels of, you know, the contaminants in mother's milk. If you do need to do a more refined assessment, it's going to tell you where to get the information that you need. And the information is going to be exposure, probably. I mean, I don't know what the sample size was based on, but if there's a simple risk management fix, go there.
Right.
So
notwithstanding the arguments about, because I've heard these arguments, so you should use the Faroe Island data or the Seychelles, it's really a spurious argument. They're both great studies. They have two different exposures, and notwithstanding the arguments about which one you should use for a methylmercury reference dose, I think the Faroe health authorities did the wise thing, is they put a fish, you know, a consumption advisory on pilot whale or blubber, because that's really what's driving a lot of the exposure to the Faroe Island children. You know, and there's probably some methylmercury stuff in there as well, and DDT for that matter. So,
Mike, also I read there's a bunch of other effects, such as Parkinson's disease, arteriosclerosis of carotid arteries. There's a bunch of other hypertension. So there's a bunch of other endpoints which are also associated with this whole thing. So
okay.
It really needs further analysis of the covariates and what is going on to understand what's going on, actually.
Okay, we have Jim, and then I think we had a question from the audience. Go ahead.
Just one other follow-up to this conversation, you know, and it ties into what we were talking about a few moments ago around the natural chemicals. It's the I'm always a little bit cautious when we start focusing on the synthetics of the looking under the things under the light of a given lamppost, and we're missing all the stuff that's outside the light of the lamppost. So when we talk about you know, adding up, just as you've done, the different hazard indexes of a, let's say a handful or a larger handful of industrial chemicals, man-made chemicals, but what you're overlooking is the light outside the lamppost of the thousands of natural chemicals that are consumed every day, some in very significant doses. And those just get totally unnoticed because they're outside the light of the lamppost, because a lot of them haven't had toxicity studies done on them and risk assessments and whatever. And it goes back to the whole issue in my mind of kind of the validation scenario of this, how do we get a feel for where these scenarios fit into, you know, the risk assessment equation when we're ignoring a significant part of the equation of the naturals. Now, of course, with the PCBs and methylmercuries, they're bioaccumulative, so they're in a bit different category, except for that in some of the naturals, your steady states are pretty high as well because you ingest large quantities every day, so you actually maintain a reasonable steady state. But it's just another question I think we have to be prepared for as we look at this whole risk assessment of mixtures, that we don't get enamored just by looking under the very narrow light of the lamppost of a few hundred, maybe of at most, of synthetic chemicals, and ignoring, for the purposes of understanding what the mixtures really mean, all those thousands of natural chemicals.
Okay, thank you. Ed, did you have a question?
Sure.
Here's the microphone right behind you.
No, one of the thoughts, and Jim raised that, with what are the manifestation of effects when you're looking at a small, intensely studied population like Faroe Islands? And, of course, you know, are they really showing effects? And you mentioned that there are some effects in the population. I was wondering if the uniqueness of the Faroe Island population, I mean, it's fairly narrow genetic profile. There are eight families, I mean, historically. So is there any thought that perhaps you're really looking at a unique subpopulation, and if there are manifestation of effects, is it related to this unique, narrowly constituted genetic profile amongst the residents?
That is true. You know, you can see that. That's why I start saying this is a unique cohort. It is probably a sensitive population, a susceptible population, so to speak. But I think the children, as Mike pointed out, whether it is prenatal, whether it is breastfeeding, they are getting a lot of exposure. And so that's actually population they are trying to protect, so to speak. And it is a unique, population.
The Seychelles is a bigger population and more genetically broad-based. Is that right?
Mike, have you looked at that? I have not looked at the population, Seychelles.
It's been too long. Yeah. I just thought those studies were really good. And they just tested different chemicals. Okay, we have two questions, actually, from the webinar. This is Eric Carlson. If the hazard indices are so high, this is referring to, I think, your presentation, Moise. If the hazard indices are so high, why are the actual health effects in the population so hard to demonstrate?
No, I think that's the reason the Ministry of Health or whatever the issues their advisors have come up with that. So it has been shown that this is causing problems. That's the reason they have come up with saying the women can eat only, the men can eat only twice a week or certain frequency, and married women who expect children and girls should not eat until they pass their age. So
And I think in the case of the Faroes, there are benchmark dose work done on the Faroes that demonstrate a 5% risk, I dimly recall, at about 66 micrograms per deciliter of blood. I believe it's, or maybe it's micrograms per liter of blood. So I think there are a benchmark dose analysis of those Faroe Island children with the neurological deficits. Go ahead, Richard.
Just want to say a little bit about the neurologic deficits, as I recall from the Faroe Island studies, were very subtle things that were difficult to show on only under severe batteries of tests to the children. And there were things like finger tapping frequency and a few things that are very, very subtle things that don't necessarily show up very easily. So, I think the big thing for the Faroe Islands would be the confounding that you might get from PCB exposure present in the whale blubber and other tissue that are not present in the Seychelles Islands. And I mean, actually, if you look at the Seychelles Islands, which had very high fish consumption rates and, you know, with definite, you know, higher levels of mercury exposure, I thought I saw what looked like a protective effect. I mean, in terms, the ones that had the higher fish consumption seemed to have better neurologic capabilities than the ones that didn't have. So, yeah, I mean, you sort of have two competing things here. You got the demonstrated positive effects of fish consumption. I mean, that's supposed to be a brain food, so to speak. I don't know how valid that is, but anyway, it's definitely has some good health benefits. But then you have the mercury, which would be a negative effect.
Okay. So just going to the point, the Seychelles have an average of 1.3 microgram per kilogram per day consumption for mercury. And the Faroes, the mercury exposure is about a third of that. So it's actually less in the Faroe Islands. And going back to Eric Carlson's question, the reason it might be so hard to demonstrate is because they were looking for neurological effects and the critical effect for PCBs, to which the infants are 600 times the RFD or twice the monkey low observed that was immune effects. So they may not have been looking at the right effect. I mean, it might be easy to demonstrate if you look at the right endpoint.
Right.
We have a second question from the web. This is Roselle Hoffman-Coit. Contois from Vermont, DEP. Can you please clarify how you developed the 9.1 microgram per kilogram dash day for PCBs and 6 microgram per kilogram per day DDT on slide 26? And I believe that's out of a publication in 2001 that we can make part of the website. I mean, slide 26, Moyes, which one is that? I think that's that consumption slide. Yeah, that's the... I think what happened there is they're presuming that the exposures from the exposure slide, which was slide number 2... Right, so you're assuming that the ratio of methylmercury to PCBs to DDT is the same as the ratio of the average consumption. Once you've made that assumption, then a given number, of methylmercury, which is EPA's benchmark dose, will be associated with these other two values. That's how it was, just an assumption. So I think that answers that question. Other questions or comments from the panel or audience or web? Okay, well, once again, we're going to thank Moy for the talk. Okay, so at this point, we have gone through our agenda. We do have observer comments and closing remarks. I'm not sure we have much in the way of closing remarks, but do we have any observer comments from the web? Any observers want to stand up and say a few words? A lot of words, just any words. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the panel and ask if you want to make any last-minute comments, and then we'll turn the meeting back over to Lynn to make sure she has any questions. So, Moyes, any last-minute comments?
Well, I really enjoyed being here, and I thank the commission for hosting us. And I think this is the first time I participated in the panel, and I always want to bring some realism to what we do in risk assessment, methods development, and I saw that streaks of that in various things, the DECQ is doing, and then some of the stuff which we presented, Ed presented today, and so it really, and the contaminated TC of contaminated sites. So these are all practical things, and I, from a health assessor perspective, I think those are good. Whenever we go to community meetings, we always have problem communicating what we are doing. I saw some graphics which would help us advance what we are doing in the communities and elsewhere, and that should encourage acceptance of methods and be able to apply them. So I look forward to that. Thank you.
Okay. Betty, any?
Nothing substantive. I just really, really appreciate that TCEQ hosting the meeting and that they've always treated us so well, and you know, and we really appreciate it.
Yes. So. You're here. Craig?
I'm just reflecting on the plans of the when we first had our meeting before this started and our focus areas of the non-cancer RFD issues and the circumstances of this meeting, in that we had a couple of discussions, and it would be nice if we could sort of in the future design a workshop around a theme and then and actually expect the, some of the presenters to stay for the whole thing so we can actually discuss all of the case studies all together. Because I think it was unfortunate that a couple of people missed certain talks, and then Nancy had to leave early and that sort of thing. There was a missed opportunity there. So it's an accident, but it also suggests an opportunity.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Jim?
I was basically going to say the same thing that Greg just mentioned, and that at this meeting we saw some opportunities occur in terms of, I think, what one of our original intents was of this series of workshop, which is to look for potential synergy amongst different cases. And I think we saw some overlap of that clearly over the last couple of days, and I think there's real value to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Richard?
I just wanted to say that I think it's been a very productive and interesting conference, and really enjoyed the case presentations, and you know, it's really some thought-provoking ideas that we can maybe take back with us and put into practice in some of our own daily risk assessment work.
Okay, so I think we had two of our panel members that were on the phone, Alan Stern and I believe Jeff Lewis, were on the phone today for various parts. I don't think they're on the phone now, and if I'm wrong, gentlemen, now's your chance to speak up. And I don't think we ever did get Annie Jarabek, right? Okay. So what I'd like to do is, before giving it to Lynn, I really want to thank several people who said this, TCEQ. As many of you may or may not know, this whole workshop series was started back, I forget how many years now, maybe four, when Mike Honeycutt of TCEQ petitioned the Alliance to build a coalition to help move the process forward. And it was done on the understanding that the NAS was a panel of 15 or so people that got together, laid some groundwork, but they also had day jobs, and they weren't going to be able to necessarily carry to fruition lots of these ideas. And so this coalition of now 56 groups is in the process of trying to do that, trying to bring some of these to fruition. And as Greg said, we have opportunities to synergize and maybe some missed opportunities, so maybe we can do a better job of bringing together a theme for the next webinar or in-person meeting. So with that, I really thank TCEQ for stepping up early on to do this and, of course, hosting us for the – is it the third time you've hosted? Three times.
Yep.
Excellent. You guys don't ever get older looking, so why is that? Maybe it's just Mike. He looks like he's aging a little bit, but the rest of you aren't. Okay, so with that, I'm going to turn this over to Lynn to close us. Dr. Haber.
And I'd just like to add my thanks to everybody who's participated. This was a wonderful, wonderfully vigorous discussion, to the panel members for all your active and good comments, to the useful comments and questions from all of the observers and those who made presentations, and to TCEQ for both hosting and providing all that wonderful logistical support. And the meeting notes will be sent to the panel members in about a month for your review and posted to the website in about 2 ± months. And check out the framework, the chemicalriskassessment.org. And it looks like Roberta Grant wants to have the last word.
Oh, good.
I really would like to recognize Allison Jenkins and Heather and Nira for rapporteuring and Angela Curry, because they really did the major portion of the organizing. They did a great job.
Okay. Thank you. We're adjourned.